was not so long ago.
Tears on My Pillow. And that's, of course, we're playing because little Anthony Imperials, and born on this day was Clarence Collins, who sang with little Anthony Imperials, born on this day in 1941. Tears on My Pillow, number one hit. We are here now to talk about national news with all of you at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. We are joined by Jackie Wellfonder, who is a conservative activist and blogger at JackieWellfonder, FONDER.com. Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University. Dr. Tara Bynum, who is assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson University. Good to have the three of you with us.
Morning.
Hello.
Morning.
Morning. 410-319-8888. So let's talk about, there's so much going on here. Let's figure where we want to start. I think so many people are abuzz about this Malaysian missing airliner, and nobody really understands what's going on. And of course, we have all these conspiracy theories that are abounding now about, you know, I read one last night that there were four Chinese scientists with a special patent, and that's why they took the plane down, and then it was all these, then it was hijacked by Persian, by Iranian. But nobody knows. But it's a very strange thing we're watching here. Have you been following it, Lawrence?
A little bit. I mean, I don't know what's going on either.
Well, I thought you knew. That's why I brought you in today.
I tell you what. You know, using my powers of reading, I read that a lot of the technology that was turned off that allowed the officials to track planes was turned off in a way that indicates that someone knew what they were doing.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so there either had to be the pilot, the co-pilot, or another person on board who understands how planes, you know, operate in order for them to have that technology turned off. So, you know, I hope we find the planes sooner or later. But I also hope that when they design these planes or in the future, they need to update it where you can't turn it off. I don't understand why you would be able to, you know, why would that be something you want to turn off ever? So that's what's interesting to me.
Jackie, you're about to say what?
Well, I was just going to say, I think that's, well, like you were saying, I think the most disturbing aspect right now is how much we don't know and the implications this could have moving forward for airline security. One of the things I was hearing this morning was there's even speculation that it could have been hijacked via a mobile phone. So it's just opening up a lot of scary possibilities, I think.
You know, I absolutely agree with that, and I wish I could say that I had an insider in the Department of Defense who actually knew everything, and I don't. But I do kind of wonder, like, why the satellites can't be helpful? You know, why can't they, I don't know, use some kind of geometry coupled with the satellites to figure that out? So there's a part of me that's like, do they really not know where that plane is? So I might end up like the rest of the conspiracy theorists, like, I don't know.
I've never been really much for conspiracy theories. There are a few I've believed in over the years, but not very many.
You're selective in your
I'm selective in my beliefs for conspiracy theories. But I think that this shows what we, as advanced as technology is, what we don't know. No, we think that every movement we have can be watched by every device in the world. Well, that's true theoretically. We technically probably don't have the ability to watch everyone's cell phone at every minute and know what's going on at every second. And that, you know, one of the things I was reading was that when they thought it went overland, that despite the tensions between Pakistan and India, that their air defenses are not always on. That, you know, they're at certain times they are and sometimes they aren't. So that there's real speculation about what people know and don't know, and that's how much a satellite can really track if certain devices are turned off. So there's a lot here that we, you know, they're saying if it went through the Indian Ocean, it could be anywhere. It's 2 miles deep at its deepest point, and be able to try to find a plane that deep. And this is you know, I think the most unsettling thing is that when people don't know an answer,
right.
Imagine those families, you know, to for there to be room for these kind of conspiracies. I mean, so they're kind of left dangling with some hope because you can't rule out. As a matter of fact, the probability that something did happen where the plane could have landed somewhere else and we just don't know has actually gone up. So it has to be a really disturbing time for those families. I can't imagine, you know, what it'd be like to go through that.
Because they don't know. At this point, they're saying that, the military radar and satellite data they do have says the plane could have ended up somewhere in Indonesia, the Southern Indian Ocean, or along this huge arc from northern Laos and China to Central Asia. And they don't know. Now they're saying that one of the pilot was somebody who supported the political opposition that's being imprisoned in Malaysia. But they're saying he wasn't a terrorist. He wouldn't have done that. I mean, so and nobody really has any handle on this at all. Is that they are? I think I do truly believe that they are. Some people think they're hiding information. I don't know why they would want to hide information. I'm not so sure I believe they're hiding anything. I think they just don't know.
And that's what's scary.
Yeah. I think that kind of lends to the whole conspiracy theory aspect. Some people have been critical because they feel like there hasn't been enough cooperation from the Malaysian government. But I'm sure this is, I would hope, this is just as disturbing to them and for everyone is the fact of how much information they don't know, that, you know, they can't just spout things out there without having some valid facts to back it up, because that's just going to make the situation worse.
And the last words were spoken by the co-pilot. And then,
yeah. I mean, they said that the plane was going, it went up to like 45,000 feet, descended to 23,000. So, you know, it was acting a bit erratically, you know,
right.
Before that took place. So I'm very concerned. And we got to find that plane.
And we'll see if they do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure.
Maybe I need to get out there and help.
That's it. We should. 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts? I mean, you can bring up any subject you'd like during this conversation that we're covering, but I'd like to hear what you're thinking and reading about that. And people have all their ideas and theories about what could or could not be happening, and who's really involved and who's leading this. Nobody really knows who's leading this investigation. There are now 11, how much is it, 30-some countries are now involved. In this investigation, and it's, we don't know, 410-319-8888. We'll get to this call coming in here in a minute and see what you're thinking. I'd like to hear your thoughts, 410-319-8888. Another issue here that's locally, I'm just curious your thoughts on this before we tackle Ukraine, the CIA, and some other things that are at the top of our news in Crimea, Russia, is the St. Patrick's Day parades in Boston and New York.
Mm.
It's interesting to see that the mayors of both cities were refused to take part. Guinness is pulled out because gay and lesbians were not allowed to participate in those marches. Though in Chicago, it's not been a problem. Dublin has never been a problem. So, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's interesting and important for the mayors to take a stand, and hopefully, that does kind of remind people that it is. A celebratory day rather than a day that should by design be exclusive in some way.
That's argument. Supposing that was Baltimore. And they said
right.
St. Patrick's Day Parade, which didn't happen here, that gays and lesbians would not be allowed to participate. What should be a public response? What should be a government response? Should there be one?
I think so. I mean, you know, America is supposed to be about equality, democracy, and everybody having a chance to participate equally, you know, and have equal protection under the law. So anytime, you know, we're engaged in marginalizing groups of people based on sexual orientation, racial classification, religion, gender, whatever the case may be, you know, we're engaged in an anti-American endeavor. And so I do think it's important that government does take a stand against this sort of behavior, and I think it's good to see.
Jackie?
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I don't think anyone should be excluded. I think people automatically assume wrongly that if gay and lesbian people are going to be included, there's going to be some kind of overtly sexual content or something, which I think is pretty ridiculous, and I don't think there's any reason why they should be excluded. As she said, it should be a celebratory day. So as long as everyone has in mind that hopefully everyone will maintain certain standards, it's a family day. A lot of people go to these parades with children. It's just a day for people to come together and have fun and have a sense of community.
I mean, I think that you know that when you this has been going on for a while. I think that the Hibernian Society in New York saying that it's against church doctrine. Of course, you have the Pope coming out and already saying that we should stop worrying about gay rights so much and deal with poverty in the world, and that should be the issue we should be focusing on. Even he is backing away and backing the church away, which we talked about last week. Well, let's see what our listeners are thinking at 410-319-8880. Then we'll move towards the CIA and U.S. Congress and Ukraine and more, and the articles in the New York Times around the lack of African-American children's literature, which we'll be doing an entire show on this week as well, coming up. 410-319-8888. And Floyd, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Mark.
Morning, Floyd.
Morning.
I was calling to voice my opinion about the CIA intel surveillance apparatus around the world here, and I believe that plane, if it was taken or if it was diverted, it may have something to do with the fact that all these bankers have mysteriously died, at least 24 over the last few months or the past year, and that the apparatus that's been set up to control not only all the financial things, as I spoke of on your show about the Baltimore housing. I believe that one of the HUD leaders in the position of Mr. Graziano out in California was threatened when she tried to find out what happened to their funding, because Daddy Bush set up a program once he became president with an executive order that allowed the CIA or our intelligence apparatus to take money from any place in the government, use it for whatever purpose they want, and not only didn't have to tell us how much they took, what they were actually taking it for. That's why here in Baltimore City, I'm trying to work with some people that want to find out why are we selling all of our public housing to private corporations.
Well, that's the subject we are going to hit again this week, and we're going to keep looking at this privatization of public housing in Baltimore, which I think is a huge issue. I'm still not convinced there's any kind of conspiracy here about this plane. I mean, because I think when we don't understand things, we leap to that a lot, but there have been a lot of bankers' deaths. Like 14 bankers have died in a very mysterious ways, committing suicide. Nobody's quite sure why this spate of bankers' deaths are taking place. But the question about, well, we can talk about this for a minute, this question about privatizing houses in this community, public housing, is a huge issue.
Well, you know, Edward Goetz, in his book, New Deal Ruins, talking about public housing policy and race, the intersection between them, he talks about that there have been 250,000 public housing units demolished in the past 20 or so years through the combination of Hope 6 and Choice Neighborhoods. And that HUD has also allocated or put another 285,000 housing units on the block for demolition. So what we're looking at and what I'm afraid of is that this rental assistance demonstration, RAD, I wonder if it is in line with this national dismantling of public housing. Now, I think the jury's still out. I listened to the interviews where Graziano came on here, and I think there's more questions. Melody Simmons talked about how there are more questions that need to be answered and more public dialogue around what's happening. But I'm concerned about it. I think this move towards privatization is actually one that's been going on for quite some time.
Since
I think we sort of, actually even before that, you look at the Interstate Highway Act of 1956 or the Urban Renewal Act back in, started with the Housing Act of 1949 and 1954. All of those included private contractors and private tiers in terms of the work that was done. So I think that, you know, private industry has been engaged with what government's been doing for a long time. So the question, I think, is more about whether or not this is going to be done with a sense of accountability. That's what you lose, is that when it is, you know, sort of handed off to the private sector, you lose the ability to hold folks accountable that you would in public government.
And that's what I was wondering about. Like, what, I mean, I guess my question was, where has privatization worked? And I think that question comes out, or part of the reason I asked that question is because of this idea of accountability and how do you hold the private companies accountable for maintaining these properties. I mean, there are checks and balances in government, even if we don't necessarily agree with what government is doing. But with the private folks, I mean, things get really tricky. And, you know, I think about the various schools that have been privatized and kind of the mass movement to privatize failing schools. I don't know that they get better. So that's the question that I need answered. Where has privatization been beneficial?
Jackie?
Well, I haven't followed this issue as closely, but I'm obviously for private enterprise and more limited government. And I think there's still going to be a level of accountability because there's still laws and regulations that they have to follow. As someone who came from that arena, I lived in public housing as a child and even as a young mother. There's definitely a need there. So I would hope there could be an integration and private enterprise could work together with the public housing arena and provide, you know, the necessary housing for people that need it and quality housing that's going to meet code and regulation.
410-319-8888. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yeah, Mr. Steiner, before on the St. Patrick's Day parade, if you're going to make a statement, you should be honest about it. You should be accurate. So what happened was with the St. Patrick's Day parade, it wasn't that any group of gays were being kept from participating in the parade. What the parade organizers were concerned about, a lot of people that are the gay persuasion were going to march with rainbow banners supporting their position. What the parade organizers are concerned about, that every group, political group, has some type of advocacy, is going to get involved with that, and it becomes a political event instead of what it's really about, the celebration of St. Patrick and about the Irish culture. So let's get it straight. And
right, let me let you set you a little bit straight, Bruce, because you're actually not quite right about this. I mean, the reality is that gay Irish groups wanted to march under their own banners and parades, which happens in Chicago, happens in Dublin, happens in cities across America. Just what happens at the very conservative leadership of Boston and New York's parades, religious conservatives did not want to let that happen. That was the big deal. And I think that the Irish, who support gay marriage, and as does the Guinness breweries and more, said we can't be part of this. And that's why the mayors of both cities refused to walk in the parades. That's why David Dinkins refused to march in the parade years back, even before all this came up. So the people didn't want a political statement. They just wanted to be part of the human family saying, we're Irish, we're gay, we're marching. And so, you know, I think that's really where it came down to. We're going to take a very brief break here and come right back. We're going to tackle the CIA in U.S. Congress. We're going to take a look at Ukraine and some of the issues that we are hitting here. 410-319-8888 that are grabbing our country's attention. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along, and so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just one second, you'd be back to bother me.
That was Smashing Pumpkins. Lead singer Billy Cogan was born on this day in 1967. Not a group that I know very much about, but I know the name. and we went out with Gloria Gaynor because her song, of course, made number one in 1971. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We are here with Jackie Wellfounder, conservative activist, blogger at JackieWellfounder.com, Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University, Dr. Tara Bynum, who is assistant professor in the Department of English at Towson. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation. I want to hear your thoughts. But let's switch gears here for a moment and look at three things, if we can get to them all, that happened in the last few days that are interesting. Looking at this increasingly widening probe, and I use my hands in quotes here in the studio, about the CIA in the U.S. Senate and Senator Feinstein's kind of pushing this issue. And Senator Feinstein, of course, being one who was not pushing very hard when it came to dealing with torture that may have taken place or dealing with the NSA and information. Now there's a little blowback here. So what's our analysis of what we're seeing here in the U.S. Congress and CIA?
Well, I'm really I'm not surprised and I'm not shocked that the CIA would be spying on the Senate. And I think we have to go back and look at COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence apparatus set up by the FBI back in the 60s and perhaps before then to spy on black activists during the Black Freedom Movement. And it's one of those things where I think we have to refer to the poet who said, never ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Right.
So when it happens to a marginalized group, we sort of bat our eyes. But what we don't realize is that when the apparatus and the sort of action of spying becomes normalized in one segment of the population, then it's only a hop, skip, and a jump away from being able to normalize it for the entire population with the NSA, and then to begin to spy on each other like we found out with United States and our European allies, and then here within our own government, the CIA spying on the Senate. So I think that's what I find interesting here is that this is not a new phenomenon. It's actually something that's been developing for at least 50 years.
I mean, one of the things that I think, Jackie, I'm going to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, that there's a difference here. I think we've lost it in some ways, at least from the post-Vietnam War era with COINTELPRO and all the kind of lies about the Vietnam War. And then Senator Frank Church, who ran what was called the Church Committee, had this comprehensive investigation of abuses of U.S. intelligence agencies, which led to the kind of judicial and congressional oversight of U.S. intelligence. And then gradually began to pull back on that over the last 40 years in this country. Last 25 or 30 years in this country, began to really pull back on that. And especially with 9/11, we have gotten to a point where intelligence agencies can almost do what they want without oversight because of people's fear of what could take place, also their fear of what the public opinion is and afraid to kind of stand up to what this overriding intelligence apparatus can do. So I think this is part of the confusion here, and most people just don't trust, I think, Senator Feinstein, given her past record. Jackie?
I think so, too. And I think, excuse me, as he just mentioned, everything that has happened with the NSA, we're at a time where people are very leery of what's being heard and what isn't and what shouldn't be heard. And I think there's now kind of the line has been blurred as far as exactly what information the American people should have. But ultimately, I think accountability and transparency are important. But obviously, national security is a huge priority as well. And I just think right now that line has been blurred so much that people don't really know what that looks like anymore.
And we've had a situation here where this one thing was leaked, the internal Panetta review, it was called, after Leon Panetta, who ran the agency, saying there was wrongdoing taking place. And now the CIA was caught in a lie, but now they're talking about suing the Congressional Committee because it was leaked.
Right.
You know?
It's a pass-the-buck scenario.
It is a pass-the-buck scenario, but I do, you know, I have to go back to the earlier point that about this idea that surveillance has been a part of the system for so long. And I think surveillance kind of by design, can it actually have checks and balances, especially when we attach it to something like security, whether it's national security, whether it's departmental security or whatever. As soon as that process begins, I think the checks, the balances, the structures kind of dismantle. And what we have is a situation that has at its root power, and how can power maintain itself? And power will maintain itself at whatever cost. So you end up with these two of warring factions in government. It's Senate's fault. It's the CIA's fault. When in doubt, it's just it's the powers that be's fault.
Yeah, and I think you really have to worry about, you do have to worry about power. Power is the operative phrase because absolute power absolutely corrupts. So when you have the power to surveil with big data, with, you know, tapping into mobile phones, looking at people's records, and you have access to such great technology, the concern has to be, you know, to quote a quote from Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
that's the thing
that I think we have to be concerned about. And to quote, look at a couple other movies, you know, whether it's the Matrix franchise or the Terminator franchise, my concern is, are we controlling our technology or is our technology controlling us? And I think if we allow these tools to become so embedded in our lives and such a part of how we are able to interact with each other, who are we giving control to based on these back doors that are in a lot of these systems?
And I wonder, too, about this kind of question of technology. I mean, technology provides us with so much information. And I don't know if we have yet even the manpower and the woman power to cipher through all of it and figure out what it is that we know and don't know, and to kind of quickly return to the Malaysian plane. You know, I wonder if it's too little information, or if it is, in fact, that we have so much information that who knows what happens. And I think when we have too much, we ultimately, the opposite effect ends up happening. We have we have so much information that we don't know what to do with it. So it might as well be too little information. There's too much for us to handle.
I agree, and I was just going to say the same thing. And I also think the fact that as far as technology and having an overabundance of information, it also gives people the wrong impression. I mean, they think like by magic we should be able to pinpoint where this flight went. And the fact that they can't is what leads to all these conspiracy theorists saying, you know, they're keeping something from us because they feel like today's technology is this magical end-all, answer-everything equation, and it isn't.
It's not, and I think that the connection for me between Malaysia and the CIA, NSA issue is that while the technology is there to track, let's say, everything, like we all have these cell phones, and most of our cell phones have GPSs. Mm-hmm. So you know, you can hit where you are, but that means you can be, the advertisers know where you are, and they can say, oh, you should go to this restaurant, which they can do, flash up on your phone and do all that stuff. However, I think that that's different from the ability of large organizations to really track your every movement. They have the technology to pinpoint it. I think I think this Malaysian airline thing speaks to that. That while the NSA, most people in this country do not want the NSA taking our phone records, don't want them kind of gleaning what we're talking to and kind of using whatever data they have to pull out like individual words that they may think have to do with connections to terrorists or whatever they're looking for. They don't have, it seems, the kind of technology to really parse all these things out in terms of individuals. Right. Nor even where planes are going. So I think that is also something with this. The technology is there, but I think it's omnipresent, but it's not as deeply intrusive as we think, maybe.
And it can't be, I would say, because technology still requires the analyst, and the analyst is the human being, and the human being can't actually, like you said, parse all the information that the technology may be able to store. You know, I was looking the other day at the video cameras that are on traffic lights, and I thought to myself, like, it's probably recording me, but where is that going? Who's watching the film? I mean, is it the case that the film is kind of somewhere in a server, or is it being, if it is being watched, like, what, where's that information going? So I think the technology is pulling the information in potentially, but that doesn't necessarily, it's like when the question of whether or not a tree falls in the forest, does anyone hear it? If anyone is pulling the technology off of whatever apparatus, but is it meaningful if no one gets to see it?
But the biggest fear, I think, for those many of us is that even though the technology we have now may not be able to pinpoint into Lawrence Brown's phone immediately or Mark Steiner's phone or anybody else's, is that that technology could get there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have this body of information you're gleaning that can be used at some point, then that's what people don't want, is to have all the information gleaned and held to be gleaned. I think that's part of the issue. 410-319-8888, your thoughts. Let's move quickly here to Ukraine for a moment. And watching this, what's happening here, in terms of the debates going on about what Americans' foreign policy should be, whether we can actually do anything about Ukraine, and also how deeply involved both America and Russia have been in internal Ukrainian politics. And they're both playing these kind of very strange roles in this political front. Jackie?
Yeah, I think it's turned into what looks like as a power struggle. Of course, you know, a lot of conservatives are painting our president as being very weak in his foreign policy, and his words not really meaning a whole lot since Putin obviously isn't listening and he's kind of doing what he wants. So I think it is creating a bit of definitely a dangerous situation, and I think that's the question in many people's minds is exactly, you know, what we can do about it moving forward or what we should do about it moving forward.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an expert on Ukrainian politics and what's happening there, but I am very much concerned about the way that the president is being depicted by a lot of the Republicans in Congress as weak. And I think for me, I think when we're looking at whether or not, you know, this could, you know, blow up into something much more serious and potentially lead to some sort of military conflict, you know, that prudence is something that should be taken into account. We really should try to understand what's going on the ground there and have the international community involved in determining whether or not there should be sanctions or what response there should be to this move by Russia. And I think that, you know, the days of unilateral cowboy diplomacy is over, and it should be over, because whatever happens, you know, the world and that region are going to have to bear the consequences of it. And so I think we should be very careful. I appreciate the president's prudence and his multilateral approach. And I hope we get to the bottom of, you know, a solution that will be sustainable.
You know, one of the things it seems to me before we switch gears here again and get our listeners' thoughts at 410-319-8888 is that, I mean, A, there's very little the West can do about Russia and Crimea. The fact is that if you look at Russian history, that Crimea has always been part of Russia for the last 800 years. It was only in the last 50 years that the USSR decided that they wanted to switch and make Crimea part of Ukraine to control Ukraine, which they were afraid was drifting to the right. So they wanted to control by leveraging it with the Russian population of Crimea, which now wants to go back to be part of Russia. We don't know our history. And also, we're not paying attention, I think, to all these other factors. I mean, the Russians are talking about this ultra-nationalist right-wing element that's taking over the government of Ukraine. That's true in certain aspects, not completely. And we are also not looking – the Americans were deeply involved in the protest movement there and in pushing this. The government was. And so it's a very complex subject, and it has to do with Russian gas and Russian oil and Russian economy being in the toilet at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's tanking. And so this is all very complex, and I think that it's the kind of thing that shows really the level of weakness of national governments to respond to what's happening in other countries. Just not
right.
We can't do it. I mean, we did it in Iraq and Afghanistan to disastrous effects in many ways. I mean,
yeah. And I think we got to look at, you know, America's own policies and the territories and lands that we have, Puerto Rico, Guam, Philippines, their influence there, the Marshall Islands. I mean, there are places, Hawaii, that we went and colonized and were able to take control of. And so I don't think we spend enough time as Americans looking internally and examining our own policy as it relates to this sort of situation, because, again, it's become normalized that we don't even think about the fact that we have this relationship with territories and properties around the world. And so I think that, you know, these sort of incidents should, I think, cause us to engage in some sort of critical self-reflection and soul-searching, so that even as we do say, you know, one thing towards Russia in terms of we want to make sure that the vote of the people is upheld, that their rights are upheld, and this is not a land grab. Let's make sure that we're looking at those very same issues here at home.
Well, we wouldn't want to do that.
I was thinking the same thing.
410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Mr. Steiner.
Hi, Clarence.
Doesn't America and the European Union only mean one thing to Putin, and that would be expansion of what he would that thing called the New World Order and NATO. So why wouldn't he be opposed to that at all costs?
So what does the New World Order mean to you, Clarence? What do you mean by that?
The expansion of European and American power throughout the world. And basically the expansion of Wall Street and the American interest to control the economics of the world or be the dominant power in what goes on economically in the world.
What's Russia's role in that, in your mind?
To be adamantly opposed to it. It's almost like the old situation. No superpower in the world is going to allow an opposing something that is opposed to their ideology to stranglehold them or surround them. And that's what Putin probably sees it as.
But I don't think this is Europe. You know, this is Ukraine, which, I mean, maybe ethnically related or racially related on some level. But, you know, you have entities dealing with each other, you know, a former part of Russia and Russia. So I'm wondering where are you making that connection with?
There's a geopolitical war going on between China, Russia, the U.S., and Western forces and economic interests. Mm-hmm. But who's going to control what portion of the world?
Right.
And I think it's being fought out in Syria and
Africa,
all through the continent of Africa. Right. It's being fought out. That's what's at work here.
Well, and that goes to my point earlier.
It's empire versus empire.
Well, countries are trying to secure resources, and that's why China's in Africa. That's why a lot of nations, your former European colonizers, are in Africa and in other places around the world trying to secure copper and minerals and resources from the land. So if Putin is doing this for Russia, we ought to recognize that as a part of, you know, what empires do. They're trying to obtain resources, trying to maintain power and dominance.
The Black Sea is a very vital export-import route that goes through and into in and out of the Mediterranean, and it's a very key, and clearly Putin's going to say, we need to control this. Mm-hmm. We can't let it fall into the Ukraine's hand, which means it'll fall into NATO's hands in Western Europe, because they'll have the influence there. This is our territory. We're going to control it. Mm. That's part of what's going on here, too. Mm. So it's all about economic power.
Yeah. And spheres of influence.
And, patriarch Americans will say that we'll stand up and go, we have to stop Russia. And right. Others will say that it's empire versus empire, and what's it got to do with me? Right?
Yep.
So 410-319-8888. There's something we're going to talk about later on this week, but I thought we hit on it the last few minutes of the show because I know that two of our guests came in the studio saying they were interested in kind of talking about it for a minute. That we were going to be talking with Charles Johnson, who wrote Middle Passage, who is now writing children's books as well, and some others to come on the program to kind of talk about where this article is written. Where are the people of color in children's books?
They are hard to find. I fortunately grew up at a time when there was, I guess it felt like, a number of Black children's books. So my mother was very intentional about having Black children's books in the house. But because I'm now grown and my friends of mine are having kids and I go out and look for kind of Black children's books, like, you got to look in the bottom of a barrel in Barnes and Nobles and hope for the best, because they don't seem to exist in the ways that they once did. Or you have to go to a Black bookstore, like Everyone's Place on North Avenue, to find Black children's books, because otherwise it's not even.
Yeah, I'm on a board now at a charter school here in Baltimore, and, you know, we're having an argument around cultural competency, implicit racial bias, and the need to address that, you know, in our systems, curriculum and teaching styles and things of that nature. And so when I read this article, I was really struck by the fact that, the author in Walter Dean Myers in this New York Times article is referring to almost a simple notion that you can't be what you can't see. And the concern for children of color is that when you don't see yourself in those books, then you're actually going to be overly vulnerable to the stereotypes that are perpetuated in society. So we know that there are negative stereotypes about Black males, about Black women, reality shows, hip-hop, which have their virtues but also have a lot of issues. And so become much more susceptible, I believe, to a lot of those negative stereotypes, lack of intelligence, prone to violence. You don't study. You're not supposed to be intellectual, because those things aren't portrayed in our media. And so I think, you know, when you don't see those things in these children's books, not only do the children of color, you know, suffer because now they're going to be oversaturated from these other perspectives, but even white children, as the author refers to,
right,
are unable to see Black people or people of color as chemists, as Walter Dean Myers says, as leaders, as, I mean, when you see yourself in these books as being that, right?
As kids yeah. in fantasy worlds.
As politicians. I mean, if you don't see that in the book.
I mean, I teach African-American literature to college students, and we aren't reading children's books. And consistently, students tell me that the books we will read will be about slavery and Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. I have, as a result of that, I've been even more selective about picking 21st century books that have nothing to do with that. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I put Octavia Butler on my list, you know, and to see their reaction, like, Black people write science fiction. They
Charles
just
Delaney,
don't, right? They don't just experience Jim Crow every day. And so, you know, these are right. children born in the 90s. It's like, you know, you don't experience de jure segregation every day of your life, and yet it's impossible to imagine that Black people would write creatively. I mean, I asked a class once, like, can Black people be creative? And they said no. And to think about kind of this idea that it does begin with children's literature and understanding that there are Black people that are just living and enjoying and being children, I think it's something to see the legacy of that in college students.
Jack, you have a thought on this?
I mean, this whole thing kind of saddens me a little bit, and it makes me realize how blessed I am to have the parents that I did and never tried to segregate me in any way or segregate themselves. I mean, I just wasn't raised to think that, and obviously Black children, there were several Black children that I was, you know, I grew up in subsidized housing. So, you know, I was with a diverse group of people, and my parents, my father was a blue collar worker. I mean, my parents had Black friends. They had friends of various ethnicities, and we had the opportunity to spend time with them in their community. So I never really thought about, and yes, foolishly as a child, but at that time, I never saw this as, you know, a completely separate environment, completely separate people that didn't have the same opportunities I did. And obviously when I grew up, or, you know, the older I got, I realized that was unfortunately much different. And I think it's sad that, you know, this one English teacher reached out to this author, but I think it's unfortunate that nobody reached out to him before that to let him know. I mean, at one point he says he was reading the story Sonny's Blues, and he said that gave him permission he didn't know he needed. And for me, that statement is heartbreaking, that he even felt like he needed permission in the first place.
And think about that. You know, millions of Black children feel that way.
Right.
Millions upon millions of Black children feel that way, that
right.
we don't have permission to be and exist outside of a Jim Crow enslavement context. You
right.
know, when I look at Common Core and the materials that I've seen in the children's school where I'm at, it only what I've seen in the social studies portion of the book, Africa's barely mentioned. And when Black people are mentioned, it's only in the context as slaves. And not even enslaved people. A small distinction, I argue, to my board, but I think it's an important one, because if the book keeps referring to your ancestors as slaves, not enslaved people.
Right.
Slavery was something
right.
that happened to us. It didn't define us.
Right.
And, but that's the way the book refers to us, and then you don't see yourself in other books. I went through the children's books that were in the classrooms that I visited.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking, well, where are the books about Black children? Where are the books about Native American children? Out of 50 mm-hmm. books, I might have found one. And it was old and couldn't engage a rat, you know. So I think that this is a real critical issue. We're not, you know, we talk about segregation in reality, but we often don't talk about segregation in media,
right.
segregation in image, in terms of images. And the impact of those stereotypes, researchers do talk about that, and we do know that implicit bias and stereotyping does have an influence on young minds, vulnerable minds, and it ends up hurting their psychology, hurting their maturation in terms of their self-image.
I mean, I can remember the day that I looked at this kind of, this was in the first grade, this girl in my class, it was a little white girl with bright blonde hair. And for whatever reason, I learned how to read on a Dick and Jane primer, even though I think
we
I'm
all
younger.
Did once.
Yeah, but
we
I
all
feel
did.
Like there might have been different strategies by the time I came around with my thought. But I just kind of remember the moment where I understood that she looked like Jane and I didn't. And right. She was able to flip her hair in ways that I couldn't. And I knew that I wanted my hair to look like right. hers. And yeah. it still doesn't and can never look like
yeah,
hers.
Dick and Jane, where's you know, where's Keisha and Keyshawn? That's what, you know, we need books that yeah. show people looking like us doing things so that we can develop positive concepts of ourselves.
One of the things we're going to try to talk about. Very quickly, we have 30 seconds left. You have the last thought, Jackie. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the important thing is not only having books like he just mentioned, but showing books of us together. I mean, being together in the same world together, not segregated.
That's also a point. And I think
it's a point, but, you know, Dick and Jane didn't have any friends in their books, so I wonder, you know,
right.
we need to make sure that we do have books that tell our story as well, even as we have those, you know, multicultural books.
Right.
So we're going to have this panel would be picking up this week to talk more about this. And Charles Johnson, who also writes now this children's book called Emery, which is about a young science geek who makes a time machine and other things that are going on there with some other authors talking about what that means. And he has very specific ideas we didn't get a chance to talk about today, which we will. But I think this is a really important subject to talk about in all its complexity. And I want to thank Dr. Lawrence Brown, Dr. Tara Bynum, and Jackie Wolfander for being here, part of this conversation. Hey, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to wrestle with Dee Watkins. We'll be in the studio. We'll wrestle with his piece that he wrote called How Glamorizing Drugs is Killing Black Kids. We'll be right back. Stay with us.